you know what it's like to be an American girl. Are you proud? Are you ashamed? Or maybe it's a combination of both. Why don't you think on it? I do. I do all the time. I'm an American woman, and it's not easy. And supposedly, I was born with my gold-plated spoon in my mouth, too. But I don't feel that way. I am Sharon Griffiths. This is Heresy, where radio speaks with a woman's voice. It's 5:08, 5:09 or so on a Sunday morning. And good morning to you all. I finally figured out when I'm supposed to be here and when I'm not supposed to be here, so I thought I'd pass it on. I am on this air, this time slot, the middle Sundays, not the first, not the last, but whatever is left over in the middle, either two or three Sundays a month of Sunday mornings from 5 to 7 a.m. And so that means I will be on, since March has five Sundays, I'm going to be on again next week, the 24th. Happy St. Patrick's Day to those people to whom that matters. And I actually had corned beef cabbage and boiled potatoes for breakfast this morning. It just kind of happened. Well, the fact that I wasn't eating breakfast until 2 in the afternoon helped a little bit, too. I don't think I could have faced that at 8 o'clock in the morning. But there's this wonderful place that my husband and I go. Very unique little greasy spoon owned by a father and a bunch of daughters who work there. And it attracts a very strange clientele. It's in downtown Passaic, New Jersey. A beautiful downtown Passaic, New Jersey. And came in today, and basically all you could get to eat, since their last name is Donnelly, all you could get to eat today was corned beef and cabbage, or you suffered the consequences, which everyone in there would give you big razz and call you names and tease you a lot. So we went with the flow and had corned beef and cabbage for breakfast. So that was my token salute to St. Patrick's Day. I'm also wearing a khaki sweatshirt, so I guess that'll get me a couple of points when I walk out here in the morning. Who knows? This morning, I am going to be, since it is still Women's Month, that time of the month for women, that time of the year for women, actually, 1/12th of it, March, even though March 8th is International Women's Day, I wanted to give you a bit of the history, as if we haven't already delved enough into the vindication of the rights of women, the Seneca Falls Convention, all the stuff that I guess most people know about, but maybe I'm assuming too much. So I brought in all my spoken word records tonight, and we're going to have a little history lesson. It's not going to be dull, I hope. Hopefully it will be interesting enough, because I'm going from 1642 until, I suppose, the present, or at least until about 1970, which is, of course, where I basically left off living. And I've been echoing around there ever since. If you've read the folio, the March folio, the folio copy that I wrote for this show is, we can't know where we're going if we don't know where we've been. And that's a variation on the slogan, the buzz phrase for the 1970 census. And again, here I am stuck in 1970, right? The slogan was actually, we can't know where we're going if we don't know where we are. And there's a regular feature in Ms. magazine as well called Where We've Been. I believe that's what it's called. Robin, forgive me if I'm not getting the words exactly right. But again, we all seem to feel that people of a certain age in our mid-30s and 40s and 50s at this point, we feel that people should know what went before and I'm one of them. So this morning, let me play for you. Let me tell you at least what I've got here. I may not get to the whole thing, believe it or not. I have a Folkways recording called But the Women Rose, Volume 1, which has, it's called But the Women Rose, Voices of Women in American History. And I've got Anne Hutchinson, Abigail Adams, Judith Sargent Murray, Emma Hart Willard, Sarah and Angelina Grimke, Frances Watkins Harper, Margaret Fuller, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Elizabeth Blackwell, Sojourner Truth, Lucy Stone, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Susan B. Anthony. Then I have got side-by-side enactments of scenes from women's history 1848 to 1920, how women got the vote. And again, we've got the heavy hitters, the all-star lineup, Sarah Grimke, the Declaration of Sentiments, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Paulina Wright Davis, Sojourner Truth, Lucretia Mott, etc., etc. And then I have But the Women Rose, Volume 2, which goes into the present from Carrie Chapman Catt, Mother Jones, Emma Goldman, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Margaret Sanger, through into Betty Friedan, the Red Stockings, Shirley Chisholm, Margaret Mead, Eleanor Holmes Norton. Another record from Cadman, whose studios used to be right where I sit. Did you know that? Cadman Records used to have their American offices right here in this suite of studios. This is called Young and Female, selected biographies from the book by Pat Ross, Margaret Sanger, Emily Hahn, Shirley Chisholm, Margaret Bourke-White, Dorothy Day, and Shirley MacLaine, before the New Age got hold of her psyche. Another record called Women Today with Lee Merriweather for broadcast the week of October 27th, 1975. Well, I'm going to play it again, sorry. 4-minute programs, and it's all going to be a surprise to both you and I. That's my spoken word. I've got a bunch of music, but first, from a book called Up from the Pedestal, Selected Writings in the History of American Feminism, goes from 1642 to the present. This is a poem by Anne Bradstreet, and it's called The Tenth Muse Lately Sprung Up in America. I would imagine it's an excerpt from the poem, but let me read it anyway. And before I do, let me ask, since I've got you all on the edge of your chairs and paying attention, I would like to ask for letters and postcards. If people know me from, or know my voice, know my style, whatever, from my old show, Cosmic Debris, which is now being hosted by Rocky and Pandora, can be heard the first Sunday of every month. But that show was at one point mine. And when I did it, I used to put out a call for postcards. I'm a postcard freak. I make collages out of them and frame them. Therefore, the basic paper white with the buffalo stamp or whatever they're using these days isn't going to make it. I prefer some artistic sentiment on one side and then the literary sentiment on the other. I have a wonderful collection from those days, the good old days of when I did Cosmic Debris. If you would like to send letters, postcards, reflecting the way you feel about the show, what I should be doing, what I shouldn't be doing, or your preferences, please write to me. The name is Sharon, Sharon Griffiths, Griffiths, and I'm at WBAI, 505 8th Avenue, New York 10018, and it would all be greatly appreciated. Some response, some feedback. I realize that I haven't been on very long in this time slot, and it takes a while to get people to realize that you're here and what you're doing and get some continuity going. I expect to be able to do that now that I know when I'm on and what I'm doing. So, as I say, any sort of postal contact will be greatly, greatly, greatly appreciated. Now let me read The Tenth Muse, Lately Sprung Up in America by Anne Bradstreet, 1642. I am obnoxious to each carping tongue. Who says my hand a needle better fits? A poet's pen all scorn I should thus wrong, for thus despite they cast on female wits. If what I do prove well, it won't advance. They'll say it's stolen, or else it was by chance. Be sure the antic Greeks were far more mild, else of our sex, why feigned they those nine? And poesy made, Calliope's own child, so amongst the rest they placed the arts divine. But this weak knot they will full soon untie. The Greeks did naught but play the fool and lie. Let Greeks be Greeks, and women what they are. Men have precedency and still excel. It is but vain unjustly to wage war. Men can do best, and women know it well. Preeminence in each, and all is yours. Yet grant some small acknowledgement of ours. Anne Bradstreet. She lived from 1612 to 1672. She came to New England during the Great Migration of 1630. And here she was asking the reader to accept the propriety of women's attempt to write poetry. I think she did pretty well. So let us start after that prologue with Volume 1 of But the Women Rose. The first speech will be from Anne Hutchinson.
The early Massachusetts Puritan community of the 17th century was in its essence a religious organization. Church and state were one, and the church dominated the state. Anne Hutchinson was born around 1590. In 1634, she came from England with her husband and children. 4 years later, she was banished from the Bay Colony for attempting a revolt against the firmly rooted oligarchy of theocrats. The fact that a woman attempted this was an outrage to these Puritan gentlemen. Governor Winthrop of Massachusetts said of Anne Hutchinson,
"A godly young woman and of special parts." She had lost her understanding. "By occasion of her giving herself wholly to reading and writing, whereas, if she had attended her household affairs and such things as belong to women, and not gone out of her way and calling to meddle in such things as are proper for men whose minds are stronger and so forth, she had kept her wits, and might have improved them usefully and honorably in the place God had set her."
During her early life in Boston, she developed a reputation as a skillful nurse and advisor in cases of childbirth and female problems. In various households, she began to hold exclusively female gatherings, and later gatherings composed of both sexes. She was the leading spirit. In the beginning, she would recapitulate and explain the substance of the clergy's sermons. At first, the elders and magistrates looked favorably at these meetings. It seemed as if the people of Boston were awakening to Christ. Then Anne began to comment on the sermons, to interpret them, to criticize them. She had set herself up as preacher. The severe old theocrats had been accustomed to having their teachings accepted as oracles. Now these teachings no longer passed unchallenged. Some people, boldly, in open meetings, challenged the minister's words almost before they had been spoken. All this boldness and independence of conscience and thought led to two trials in 1637. The first was civil, the second was religious. The result was banishment for Anne and her family from the Massachusetts Bay Colony. In 1776, Abigail Adams, wife of John Adams, wrote a letter to a friend in which she described her husband's response to her suggestions that the Constitutional Congress devise a new fair code of laws to rectify the intolerable legal position of the American woman.
Mr. Adams is very saucy to me in return for a list of female grievances which I transmitted to him. I thought it was very probable our wise statesman would erect a new government and form a new code of laws. I ventured to speak a word in behalf of our sex, who are rather hardly dealt with by the laws of England, which give such unlimited power to the husband to use his wife ill. I requested that our legislators would consider our case, and as all men of delicacy and sentiment are averse to exercising the power they possess, yet as there is a natural propensity in human nature to domination, I thought the most generous plan was to put it out of the power of the arbitrary and tyrannic to injure us with impunity by establishing some laws in our favor upon just and liberal principles. I believe I even threatened fomenting a rebellion in case we were not considered, and assured him we would not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we neither had a voice nor representation. I wrote, "In the new code of laws, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion. And in return, he tells me he cannot but laugh at my extraordinary code of laws, that he had heard their struggle, had loosed the bonds of government, that children and apprentices were disobedient, that schools and colleges were grown turbulent, that Indians slighted their guardians and Negroes grew insolent to their masters. But my letter was the first intimation that another tribe, more numerous and powerful than all the rest, are grown discontented. This is rather too coarse a compliment," he adds, "but that I am so saucy, he won't blot it out."
Using the pen name Constantia, Mrs. Judith Sargent Murray wrote many articles, stories, and opinions. In 1790, she wrote an article for the Massachusetts Magazine entitled, "The Equality of the Sexes."
"Is it upon mature consideration we adopt the idea that nature is thus partial in her distributions? Is it indeed a fact that she hath yielded to one half the human species so unquestionable a mental superiority? Yet it may be questioned, from what source doth this superiority in this determining faculty of the soul proceed? May we not trace its source in the difference of education and continued advantages? Will it be said that the judgment of a male 2 years old is more sage than that of a female of the same age? I believe the reverse is generally observed to be true. But from that period, what partiality? How is the one exalted and the other depressed by the contrary modes of education that are adopted? The one is taught to aspire. The other is early confined and limited. As their years increase, the sister must be wholly domesticated, while the brother is led by the hand through all the flowery paths of science."
In the early days of the United States, women were in many ways equal to men. They owned property or managed it, and also had the right to vote. Between 1700 and 1800, however, the colonies, and later the states, took the vote away. Sarah and Angelina Grimke were sisters born into a slaveholding family in South Carolina. In the early 1800s, as adults, they became organizers and speakers in the anti-slavery movement. Condemned for speaking publicly and thereby abandoning their rightful sphere as women, the sisters nonetheless firmly maintained their right to speak out on issues. Sarah Grimke, answering a charge by the Congregationalist Church of Massachusetts, wrote,
I ask no favors for my sex. I surrender not our claim to equality. All I ask of our brethren is that they will take their feet from off our necks and permit us to stand upright on that ground which God designed us to occupy. If he has not given us the rights which have, as I conceive, been wrested from us, we shall soon give evidence of our inferiority and shrink back into that obscurity which the high-souled magnanimity of man has assigned us as our appropriate sphere.
In 1840, the anti-slavery movement split. At a worldwide conference on abolition held in London, men voted to bar women from participating. Angered by this action, Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who were present at the convention, resolved to form a society to advocate the rights of women. It took 8 years, but finally, in 1848, 5 women, including Mott and Stanton, planned and called a meeting for July 19th and 20th in Seneca Falls, New York,
to discuss the social, civil, and religious condition and rights of women.
This convention unanimously approved a Declaration of Sentiments, which paraphrased closely the familiar Declaration of Rights, stating that
all men and women are created equal.
The declaration ended,
now in view of this entire disfranchisement of one half the people of this country, their social and religious degradation, in view of the unjust laws above mentioned, and because women do feel themselves aggrieved, oppressed, and fraudulently deprived of their most sacred rights, we insist that they have immediate admission to all the rights and privileges which belong to them as citizens of the United States. In entering upon the great work before us, we anticipate no small amount of misconception, misrepresentation, and ridicule, but we shall use every instrumentality within our power to effect our object.
The Seneca Falls Convention also adopted a set of 12 resolutions. Among these was one calling for the right to vote, which was considered very radical and passed by only a small margin. The women decided that they had a great deal more to discuss. They also wanted to make their views known to a larger audience, so they called a second convention for 2 weeks later in the city of Rochester, New York. At this convention, the call for the vote passed with a larger majority, and suffrage became an established goal. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who first introduced the resolution calling for the vote, was always more radical than her peers. She was outspoken in the temperance movement as well as the abolitionist movement. She saw the struggle to control the use of alcohol as an issue directly related to women's rights, and shocked many when, in 1852, she advocated divorce as a protection against alcoholism. Speaking in 1853, she explained some of her views.